We are in part four of our sermon series on singleness, marriage, divorce, and remarriage. In week one, we talked mostly about divorce and remarriage. Then in week two, we took that as sort of a cleanup week. We needed some time to just finish up on some of those thoughts that we began in that first teaching. Then last week, in week three, we went down through 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 through 7, and talked mostly about finding your proper calling and gifting in life, where you called or gifted to be single, where you called or gifted to be married, and whatever your calling and gifting was, Paul's encouragement to us was to get into that calling. If you're not in that calling and you have that calling and gifting, be praying, be open to what the Lord is doing. Get yourself into that calling and gifting so that you can, in that calling and gifting, live a faithful life to the Lord. Whether that's the single and celibate lifestyle or whether that's the married lifestyle, that you might live that lifestyle, the lifestyle that God has called you and gifted for, in a faithful and successful way. Now today we're going to pick up at verse 8. And we're going to continue on down through 1 Corinthians 7, the marriage chapter. And what we're going to be doing is sort of taking all of these things that we've talked about, because we have in some way or another brushed past or covered in depth all of these subjects. And now today we're just going to start that walk down from verse 8 on, where we're looking at all of these things and we're tying them all up together. We're putting the finishing touches on the study. We may get done today. We may not. And if we don't get done today, I'm not sure what we're going to do for next week. We'll be praying about whether we want to do another week in this sermon series or whether we want to get back to our chapter by chapter, verse by verse study through Luke. So for today, we're going to pick up at verse 8 and continue on through the chapter. We will not be covering all of these verses in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. This is not meant to be a chapter by chapter, verse by verse study through 1 Corinthians 7. So we'll do this in a chapter by chapter, verse by verse, in-depth way when we're studying 1 Corinthians chapter 7. But for now, what we're going to do is pick up a lot of this. We're going to pick up the verses that we need, because in this chapter is important information that we really don't find anywhere else in the Bible. And if we do, it's not quite worded and reasoned the way that the Apostle Paul has worded and reasoned it. So this is important stuff to our study. In today's study, I hesitate to inform you, is going to need to be a very technical study. So if you're not quite awake today, if you're not as mentally sharp as you normally are at, say, 2 or 3 in the afternoon, or if digging through the Greek language, the original manuscripts, isn't really your cup of tea, can I recommend that you go back to the coffee table and get a cup of coffee and just hang in there with me as well as you can. We need to be technical today because this stuff is very important, and if we're not technical as we study through this, then we leave the door open for misconceptions. And I don't know about you, but I feel like there are already way too many misconceptions around all of these topics, and I don't want to open this up for even more misconceptions. Remember that can of worms? You know, sermon series study number one, I opened that can of worms. Well, now we're trying to grab each one of those worms, explain them, make sense of them, and stuff them back in the can. All right, so let's begin at verse 8. Actually, before we do that, before we start reading in verse 8, there's some technical groundwork that we need to lay. We need to define four terms that we're going to see repeatedly in this chapter. If we don't understand what those four terms are biblically, we're going to run into all sorts of issues trying to interpret what Paul is saying in the chapter. That is going to create room for error. That is going to create room for misconception. So four terms that I want you to know. We'll start off with an easy one. It is the word married. You're going to see that term in here. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the word married. And it's from the Greek word gamos. Gamos. Does that word sound familiar? It should, because you've heard of the word monogamous, right? Monogamous. You've heard the word polygamous. Well, the root in there you can hear is the word gamos. That's the Greek word that means married. So you can very easily define those words, because mono means what? One. So monogamos, that means married to one. Poly means what? Multiple or many. So polygamos means married to multiple or married to many. So what does gamos mean? It's the root for married. Easy one. Second one. The second word we need to find is another easy word. It's the word widow. You're going to see that multiple times in this chapter. It comes from the Greek word kairos, and it means a person that was married but lost their spouse due to death. So widow means widow. Married means married. Widow means widowed. Third, we have the English word virgins. And, oh good, I don't need to be guarded in my conversation today. We have the word virgins. It's the Greek word parthenoi. And the Greek definition is virgin, or by implication, someone that has never been married. All right, I need you to get the first definition out of your head. That's not how Paul uses it in 1 Corinthians 7. He uses the second definition, which is a person that has never been married. Everyone got that? When you see the word virgin, Paul is referring to someone that has never been married. And now comes the fourth one, the tough one. It's the English word unmarried. It's a tough one. What does that mean? Well, it comes from the Greek word agamos. That sounds familiar, right? It should. We just talked about the word gamos, which means married. Now we have the word agamos. So what does that word mean? We know what polygamos means. We know what monogamos means. What does agamos mean? Well, what happens, does anyone know, when you take the letter A, or the Greek letter alpha, and add it to the beginning of a Greek word? What does it do to that Greek word? That makes the Greek word a negative, or in other words, it puts that Greek word at a deficit. Let me give you an example. You've heard of the word agnostic, right? Well, that word agnostic is two Greek, well, it's a Greek word with a Greek prefix of A or alpha. The word gnostic means what? Knowledge. So what does that word knowledge, gnostic, mean when you add the A to it? When gnostic becomes agnostic, what does the word mean? It literally means without knowledge. When you add that prefix of A, it means without or in a deficit of. By the way, use that with your agnostic friends when they tell you that they're agnostic. Make sure you fill them in on that. Say, wow, I'm sorry to hear that you are without knowledge. If you're interested in having some knowledge, I can help you with that. Come to our church. We'll help you. But so that word agamos is the same way. When you take that word gamos, which means married, and you add the prefix A to it, that's telling you that this is a person who now has a deficit within the marriage. That is, they were once married and now they are without a marriage. That's the definition by the Greek. And if you don't want to accept that definition by the Greek, that's fine. We're going to also do with these words what we've done with every other word that we've defined in this study. We're going to also not only use the Greek language to define it, but we're also going to use the context that it's used in to define it. And that is exactly what we see take place in 1 Corinthians 7. You're going to see that Paul is going to give the definition of unmarried to us in verse 11. Can you throw that verse up on the screen real quick? Just to give you an idea here. If you look at verse 11, that scripture says that if a woman does depart from her husband, she becomes what? unmarried. It doesn't mean she's never been married, right? So unmarried, we can't look at it the same way that we look at our English word. We use that word for everything. We say of a person that's never been married, we say, well, they're unmarried. A person that was married and is now divorced, we say they're unmarried. And the person that was widowed, they were married and their spouse died, we say they're unmarried. We use it for everything. Paul did not. Paul handled every single one of these words very differently and very separately. We have a word to reference those that have lost their husband due to death. Widow. Kerize. We have a word that identifies those that were never married. Parthenoi. Virgin. We have a word to identify the married. Gamos. And we also have a word to identify people that were in a marriage, but now have a deficit of marriage. That is, they no longer have that spouse, but they were married at one time. The easiest way to define this is with the word divorce. But most translations do not do that. But again, if you just let the text show you, you'll see how Paul uses this. You'll see that in verse 8, Paul differentiates between the unmarried and the widow. You'll see in verse 27 and 28, Paul differentiates between the unmarried and the virgin, Parthenoi. He handles these very differently. So what I need you to get in your mind from the start here is that when you read that word, unmarried, you can't think of it like we use the word unmarried. You have to think of it the way that Paul is using the word. So think of it like this. The unmarried person in 1 Corinthians 7 is the person that was at one time married, but then unmarried that spouse. All right, are you with me? With that in mind, I think we can begin reading. Married means what? Married. Widow means what? Widow. Virgin means what? Never married. And what does unmarried mean? It means divorced. Verse 8. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows. So you see how Paul keeps those two things separate, right? If he wasn't separating these out, this would be a little monotonous and redundant and superfluous. But Paul is handling these separately. See, to us, a widow would be considered an unmarried person. Not to Paul. They're different. There's different words for them. Paul does not include the virgins, Parthenoi, in his verse 8 statement. That is, those that have never been married, because he's going to talk about them later on in the chapter. He keeps them separate, and you'll see that when he gets to the virgins and he starts to talk about those that have never been married, he's going to repeat this same counsel. He's going to use some different words. He's going to introduce some different reasoning, but he's going to essentially give this same counsel, only he's keeping them separate so as to cover every category so that we're not confused. But what do? We read this and we're very confused. That's why we have to be technical here today, all right? Now, right now, Paul is specifically speaking in verse 8 to divorced people and widowed people. In other words, here's where he starts. Those with experience in marriage. Those that are used to being in a married relationship and have suddenly found themselves in a position where they are now living a single lifestyle. And here's what Paul says, reading on. It is good for them if they remain even as I am, which would be single and celibate. But as we learned from both Paul and Jesus last week, a person cannot live a single and celibate lifestyle if they are not called to it and gifted for it by God. Jesus said it was only for those who were so given or gifted. Jesus said, not all can receive this lifestyle, there in Matthew chapter 19. And last week, that was our major focus of verses 1 through 7, wasn't it? It was Paul saying that both the single life and the married life are giftings, and where you get into trouble is where you try to live outside of your giftings. It's like a fish trying to live out of water. You're fighting against the grain of what God has internally gifted you for. And that's going to cause you problems. So yeah, Paul says, verse 8, my personal recommendation is for you to try the single life. You were married, you're divorced now, or your spouse died. That's what he's saying in verse 8. And here's my recommendation, give it a try. Try the single life. Stick with it for a while. Try the celibate lifestyle. Give it a go. Pray about it. It might be something that the Lord wants to gift you for. Remember we said God can change this up on you as the years pass. Remember we said some people get married and then they end up divorced and they say, that's it. I am forever done with men. I am forever done with women. That's one indicator that your gifting is changing. Maybe it's good for you to stay single and celibate for a while. That's Paul's advice. It might end up working out for you. It might be a wonderful lifestyle for you. Man, you can just completely focus on the Lord. You don't have to worry about what the old man wants for breakfast. Oh, I can't pray and do my devotions this morning. Got to get up and cook breakfast for him. Or you don't have to worry about, well, my evening time is gone because I got to take the trash out for the old bag. Oh, did I say that? Oh, my gosh. I got responsibilities from my wife, so I don't have time to. No, there's none of that. There's no distractions from trying to keep the spouse happy. It's a good lifestyle in that sense. You can just be completely focused on the Lord. So try it, Paul says. But verse 9. He's going to take us right back to where we were in verses 1 through 7. He's going to say, but if they cannot exercise self-control, then let them marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Again, this truth is for who? The divorced and the widows. And what we have here in verse 9, whether you want to recognize it as such or not, is a mega truth about the human condition. It is a mega truth, and unfortunately, way too many Christians do not want to acknowledge this truth when they are dealing with the situation of divorce and remarriage. Sure, there are obvious cases where a spouse has been sexually unfaithful within the marriage. And we understand that the Lord gives us that concession that in that situation, those partners may divorce and remarry without committing further sin. We understand that there are cases where an unbiblical divorce takes place. That is, it was not done based on biblical grounds, that exception clause of fornication. And later on, after that divorce, one of the spouses breaks the sexual bond between the marriage with either an affair on the marriage after the divorce or a remarriage where, of course, sex is going to take place within that marriage. And we understand there, too, that that is another situation where that marital bond, that sexual bond between the old spouses is now broken. And that person, both of them actually, is now free to remarry. But what do we do in the cases that aren't quite so clear? What do we do in the cases where we have a couple that has divorced for unbiblical reasons, and neither them or their former spouse has moved on? What do we do? Paul's going to tell us shortly. Here's the first step, stay unmarried or be reconciled. Because what do we say? The sin that takes place within divorce and remarriage is that sin of sexually breaking that sexual bond between you and your former spouse or you and your current spouse. That's the sin. Fornication in general, specifically adultery, the sin of a married person against their partner or former partner. So you got to understand what Paul and what Jesus and what Moses have tried to do is to teach us how to navigate marriage, well, single life too, single life, marriage, divorce, and remarriage without committing sin. That's the counsel that the Bible is going to give you. But there is nothing in the scriptures that teach us that if you do commit sin in this area, that you've somehow landed yourself in a state of sin and that you are completely unsavable and unredeemable. I don't find that anywhere in the scriptures. In fact, I find a whole lot of the opposite of that. So what do? You've divorced for unbiblical reasons. Neither one of you were unfaithful. You didn't divorce for the new exception that the Apostle Paul is going to give us in this chapter. You've divorced on unbiblical grounds. Your partner, your former partner, is not moving on. And you don't want to be the one to commit the sin. What do? I think this verse needs to be considered in a situation like that. I know many Christians would rather shame people for remarrying in such cases, but consider this mega truth that Paul just dropped on us. Does this truth not go hand in hand with what God himself said in Genesis chapter 2, verse 18, that it is not good for the man to be alone, vice versa? Does this truth not go hand in hand with what Paul and Jesus both said to us about living a single and celibate lifestyle? In other words, it's not good. It's fish out of water. It is living against the entire grain of what you're gifted for. And this goes right hand in hand with that. These are high truths about the human condition that we cannot ignore. It is not good for a person that is incomplete outside of a marriage relationship to be forced to live outside of a marriage relationship. And if that person is really truly struggling with the passions of the flesh, then it may be, I'm not saying it is, I'm saying it may be better for them to just remarry than it would be for them to commit the daily sin of lust or some other sexual sin that they can't conquer. All I know is that Paul did not say here's what Paul did not say. He did not say, if an unmarried person cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion, unless you were divorced on unbiblical grounds, then it's better for you to just sit there and burn with passion. That is not what the passage says. By the way, the King James Version here translates this to say that it's better to marry than to burn. Now, I was raised on the King James Version Bible. That's what I started reading when I was young. And I'm dead serious about this. The first time I read that passage, it is better to marry than to burn, I seriously thought that meant it is better to marry than to burn in hell. And I thought, wow, that's not very encouraging. Paul really was against marriage. You know, it's like, hey, don't get married, but, well, if you do have to get married, it's a little bit better than hell. That's really what I thought he meant. And then I read the rest of the chapter where Paul's saying, don't get married, just try not to get married. And I thought, yeah, that is what he's saying. Better to get married than to burn in hell. Slightly better. No, that's not what Paul was saying. The New King James Version is definitely a better translation on that one. He is saying, for sure, it's better to get married than to burn with passion. Now, can you see, folks, how people with failed marriages might wind up in a jam? We have to be so careful when we judge others. Can you see how people that end up in failed marriages may need to end up travailing over the lesser of two evils, as it were? Is it better for me to maybe potentially risk that sin of the remarriage, the act of adultery in that remarriage? Is that better than me sitting here every day wrestling with my lust, daily having to confess sexual sin and sexual passion that I'm failing at? Is that better? That's something for people in those situations to travail over. And I say, as the church, we should walk very softly around them. In fact, that's a good general principle. Walk softly around broken hearts. Walk softly around broken lives. I personally knew a guy that just really helped me to see the magnitude of what Paul's saying here. Better to marry than to burn with passion. I knew a guy who was a professed Christian, watched his life for a while. I pastored him for a while. His wife left him when they were both fairly young. And I don't know her whole story. I don't know if she was a believer or an unbeliever. That happened before I met him. I don't know if the marriage ended because of unfaithfulness. I don't know why she left. I don't know what she did after the divorce. It may have been actually possible that he had the biblical right to remarry all along, but his church organization convinced him that it could never be okay for him to remarry. He was a firm believer that you had one shot at marriage, and if you got that wrong, then you had to stay single for the rest of your life or be reunited to that former partner. Now, we talked about Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. We're tying it all back together again, right? We know from Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, that if a married couple divorces and those partners move on and have relations, sexual relations with others, or remarry other, what was Moses' counsel? He says the worst thing you can do in that situation is go back to the original spouse. That's the worst thing you can do. So, again, this guy believed that even if she moved on, even if she found a new guy, even if she was sleeping with someone else, even if the marriage was definitely permanently over, that he had no option but to stay single. And let me just share with you the problem that I saw with that. Let me put it to you like this. This guy, believe me, this guy was not gifted for the single life. This guy was not gifted for a celibate lifestyle. So, at the risk of committing a sin in a new relationship, what he chose to do was daily wrestle with the passions of his flesh. And it was a sad thing to watch as the family members that he lived with would on a somewhat regular basis find his computer screen up with pornographic images on them or messages from webcam girls. Week after week, year after year, he struggled with sexual sin. I was completely embarrassed for him. And I am a firm believer that if the Apostle Paul could speak to him, the Apostle Paul would give him this counsel. He would say, "Geesh, dude, wake up and smell the coffee. Go get a wife, man. You need one. You're not gifted for the single life. It is not good for you to be alone. How can you possibly think that stewing in your sexual sin day after day is more spiritual and more honorable than maybe breaking that marriage bond, maybe being the one that goes out first and commits the sin? It is an unfortunate situation to be in. And I never want to give counsel in that situation. I want that person to seek the Lord for themselves. But we have to keep in mind something. We're afraid of the passages that say that the unrepentant, practicing adulterer will not inherit the kingdom of God. But you know the word fornicator is in there too, right? It's not just the adulterer, but it is the unrepentant, practicing fornicator that does not inherit the kingdom of God either. So you've got to ask yourself in that situation, as I look at this principle, perhaps it's better to marry than to burn with passion. Perhaps it might be a better thing for me to just accept the failing of the marriage, move on, confess that broken marriage, confess that mess that I've made, ask the Lord to forgive me, by faith receive His forgiveness, and ask the Lord to bless where I am and bless where I'm going in my life. It's a tough one. You can disagree with that if you want, that's fine. But you see the strait betwixt that those people are in, right? I mean, you see the conflict of truths and principles, right? So we at least take away this mega truth from Genesis 2:18, Matthew 19:11 and 12, 1 Corinthians 7, 1 through 19. Here's the mega truth that we take away from that. It is that if at all possible, never live a lifestyle that directly places you in the path of continued intense temptation. Now, you can't argue that statement. Paul made that statement. You can't argue that statement. Where we can have arguments, perhaps, is on how to apply that statement. But you can't argue that statement. Do not intentionally live a lifestyle that directly places you in the path of continued intense temptation. You are setting yourself up to fail. You are trying to live in a state that you are not called and gifted for. Verse 10. Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord. So what's Paul saying there? Paul is saying, I'm giving you married people a command, and it's not just coming from me. This is what the Lord said about the topic of marriage. So this is going to be the gold standard, right? Paul's quoting the Lord. He's saying we have the written words of God the Father and God the Son on this topic. We already know what it's going to be, don't we? If you want to hit the mark, if you want to hit the bullseye for marriage, here it is. Here's the bullseye. Verse 10, reading on. A wife is not to depart from her husband. Look at that word, depart. This does not mean skipping town for a bit. This does not mean taking a break from the marriage. This does not mean temporary separation to go live with her sister for a few weeks. This is the word charizo in Greek. And I kid you not, this word means to put asunder. We would say divorce. So when you read that word depart, it's the word charizo. It means to put asunder. Verse 11. But, I love this. It's so human. Paul says, the woman is not to depart from her husband. She is not to put away her husband. But, Paul, knowing human nature, says this. But even if she does depart, even if she does put asunder that relationship, let her remain. Now, do you see the proof of what I'm saying about the word depart? The word depart means to divorce. It doesn't mean to leave for a little bit or separate for a little bit. If she departs, if she divorces, Paul says, let her remain, what? Unmarried, without a marriage, minus a marriage. So if she divorces, she's not supposed to, but Paul knows human nature. If she does divorce, the Lord would say, don't remarry, stay divorced. Or be reconciled to her husband unless what? Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. Unless that spouse has moved on and found another partner, then she's not to be reconciled to her husband. Everyone with me? Am I tying this all together? Or am I loosening it up and making it even worse to understand? Well, reading on, he says, likewise, a husband is not to divorce his wife. Same thing applies to the husband. So once again, we get the Lord's position on marriage, and it's the gold standard. We don't get the exception clause for fornication here, do we? But it is a biblical exception, isn't it? Here's what we have to be extremely careful with as we study what Paul is saying. Everything that Paul is talking about coincides with everything that the Bible says on the topic. So when he says that the woman is not to depart, but if she does depart, she needs to remain unmarried, he is not talking about those situations where there are biblical grounds for divorce, is he? We have to be able to maintain multiple thoughts in our head as we're studying through this. We know this is referring to God's advice. Try to work it out. And if you get divorced, fine. Try to stay divorced. Because, why? There's a chance it may work out. There's a chance that marriage might have a shot in the end. Give it some time. Don't rush off and find a new spouse. Give it time, and maybe, just maybe, there can be healing and restoration there. All right? Now, we know that there is an erroneous argument out there that is often made that they say that depart here in this situation does not mean divorce. They say this means to separate if you have to, but don't divorce. But you saw it right there, didn't you? Paul calls this woman that departs unmarried, agamos, without a marriage, a deficit of marriage. So we know he is talking about divorce here. All right, verse 12. But to the rest, I, not the Lord, say. Now who was speaking in verse 10? Paul said, I'm giving you a command, but it's not just for me. This is the Lord's word. Now what is Paul doing in verse 12? I love how he handled this. He did not want to misquote the Lord. He'd say, here's what we know from the Lord. Here's what we have in black and white. Here's the recorded words of God the Father and God the Son. But now Paul says in verse 12, here's what I say. Here's my opinion on the situation. The Lord never spoke this. That's what Paul's saying. These are outside of recorded biblical words from the Lord. It is not written in Scripture, what I'm about to tell you. But here's my opinion on the matter. And that tells me something, first off. It tells me that the Lord was intentionally vague on this topic. Tells me that the situation is a unique situation and it's a tricky one. That's what it tells me. The Lord was intentionally vague on this topic. Why would he be intentionally vague on this topic? Well, it's real simple, human nature. If it's your kid's chores to wash the dishes, and your kids are over there and they start to wash the dishes, and you walk up to them and say, hey kids, I just want you to know I would really prefer it if you finished washing the dishes. That's what I want for you, but if you have to, you can go outside and play and I won't be mad. But listen, I really want you to finish the dishes. What are the kids going to do? They're bailing on the dishes. So if the Lord just like gave us a chapter where he said, okay, you can divorce for this and for that and the other, and if your wife does that and if your husband says that and if he spends too much time there or she does this, if the Lord did that, what would we be doing? I mean, the first time we got upset with our spouses, we'd be digging through that chapter. We'd have it memorized. Like, is there any reason today that I can divorce that bozo? I think maybe verse 12. That's what we'd be doing because of human nature. So the Lord is intentionally vague on this, so much so that the Apostle Paul, the foundation of New Testament doctrine, had to give his opinion to us based on what he collected from the Scriptures and what he learned from the heart of God. And that tells me there's room for my opinions too. And yours. As long as they're not different from mine. No, I'm kidding. There's room for opinions in this because the Lord is vague, but here's what we have to be very careful with. We have to do what Paul did. When we're giving counsel to others, we have to do what the Lord said and what Paul did. When we're giving the gold standard, here's what we say. Here's what the Lord wants. Work it out. No matter how bad it is, if you can work it out, work it out. That's God's best for you. But here is my opinion. And then we give our opinion. We make sure we specify, just as Paul did, right? And by the way, if you're going to have an opinion, please at least study, at least dig through this, all right? It's important because if we persuade people and we send them in the wrong direction, we are accountable for this. Keep that in mind. Reading on verse 12. If any brother has a wife who does not believe, that is, she is an unbeliever. The Greek language is absolutely clear about this. This is referring to an unbeliever. If a brother has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, it works both ways. If he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. Verse 15, but if the unbeliever departs, and again, that is the word charizo, which means to put asunder. If the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage. That marriage bond is no longer a thing of bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. Now stop right here for a minute, because what we have in verses 12 and 13, unfortunately, I hate to say it, I love the New King James Version, but what we have here is a very weak translation of three different words. You see the words that are twice mentioned, willing to live. Do you see that? If a brother has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him. And then it says the same thing about the man that has an unbelieving wife. Or pardon me, vice versa. A wife that has an unbelieving husband that is willing to live with her. That is a poor translation because that comes from the word, the Greek word, sunyudokio. Sunyudokio. I know it sounds Japanese or whatever, but it's not. It's a Greek word, and it means to be gratified with. It means to be pleased with. It doesn't just mean what the New King James Version says here, if they're willing to live with you. It goes much deeper than that. We have to be technical here, because this is stuff that divorces happen over or don't happen over, and we need to know what the technical issues are here. This word is telling us that if an unbelieving spouse is married to a believing spouse and that unbelieving spouse is gratified by the marriage, pleased to be in the marriage, that the believing partner should what? Not depart, not divorce, not end the marriage. But it's a real thing. It doesn't just mean, well, he's cranky all the time, but he won't divorce me. We're talking real stuff here. We're talking about, I mean, can you tell the difference when someone's pleased in a marriage and gratified within a marriage and when they're not? I can. As I mentioned in passing, if the wife is serving as a punching bag for the husband, I think actions speak louder than words in that case. And regardless of what he says with his lying mouth, his actions are proving that he is not pleased, that he is not gratified to be in that marriage. Would you agree? Likewise, if the woman is spending all her time down at the bar, can't stand the man, she's not having affairs, but she's down at the bar spending all her time, and when she comes home, she wants nothing to do with the husband. Does that speak of being pleased and satisfied with the relationship, with the marriage? I don't think so. Not in my opinion. Now, Paul tells us that if the unbelieving spouse is pleased to stay in that marriage and things are going well. Great. Believer, stay put. Stay with that unbeliever if they're pleased to be in the marriage and things are going well. I like how the scripture doesn't say if you can put up with their unbelieving ways, then stay in the marriage. But it says if they can put up with your believing ways, then stay in the marriage. In other words, if they can put up with you and your Christianity, then stay in the marriage. Because he's going to go on to tell us, verse 14, that might be the thing that wins them to Christ. You staying in that marriage, you loving them with the love of Christ, that may be the thing that brings them to Christ. All right? But by implication, folks, if that unbelieving spouse is genuinely not pleased to be in the marriage, then the believer is allowed to divorce and remarry. Would you agree with that? It couldn't mean anything else. If we were to stop that line of thought right there and say, no, the believer does not have the right to divorce and remarry, even if the unbelieving spouse isn't pleased to stay in the marriage. If we were to say that, then that defeats the whole purpose for Paul to make this statement at all. Paul would either not say anything about this, he'd either not bring this topic up, or he would say something like this: whether the unbeliever is pleased to be in the marriage or not, the Christian is to stay in the marriage. So we're given an obvious implication, right? Believer, you stay in the marriage if they're pleased to be in the marriage. Woman, if he's using you as a punching bag, he is not pleased with that marriage. And I don't care what he tells you. I don't care if he doesn't want the divorce or she doesn't want the divorce. If that sort of stuff is going on, I think the obvious choice is there. And shame on any pastor that would tell a woman to stay in a situation where she's being abused physically. That's no longer a biblical issue, you understand? That's a legal issue. That's an issue of crime. All right, that's my take on it. I hope you agree. So no playing games on this one. That's what I take from this. If that spouse treats you like garbage, whether they divorce you or not, you as a believer have the right to be out of that marriage and free to marry. Why? Because God has not called you to bondage, but to peace. So you see what we have here, right? We have another exception for a divorce on biblical grounds. Jesus didn't give us this one. Moses didn't give us this one. Paul, in his best counsel, gives us this one. It is a very definite second exception for divorce on biblical grounds. Now, why would this be a biblical exception for divorce? This actually is not a new topic. This has always been the Lord's command from Old Testament to New Testament that a believer should never marry an unbeliever. And if two unbelievers get married and only one of them ends up converting, a tough decision has to be made. Because two cannot walk together except they be agreed. Amos 3:3. You got a world, if he's got a worldview or she's got a worldview and you've got a biblical worldview, it's going to be tough to walk together in life, right? Because a believer and an unbeliever should never be unequally yoked in a relationship. 2 Corinthians 6:14. Because we are to marry only in the Lord, 1 Corinthians 7:39. That has always been the biblical teaching, Old Testament to New Testament. Believers do not marry unbelievers. Ezra, the Old Testament priest, he saw this as cut and dry. And during the rebuilding of the temple after that captivity up north, right there in Ezra 10, Ezra commanded the Jews to put away, to divorce their heathen, pagan, unbelieving wives. You realize that? Nehemiah dealt with the same issue in Nehemiah chapter 13. And they handled it differently. I love to watch how they handled it so differently. When Ezra found out that the Jews had married heathen wives, Ezra chapter 9 verse 3 tells us that Ezra rose up, tore his garment, and plucked out the hair from his head and his beard. He was just mad that a believer, that someone from the household of faith would marry an unbeliever. And he tore his hair out and he tore his beard out and he forced them to put away those wives. Nehemiah handled it a little bit differently. Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 25, it says that when Nehemiah found out that believers, Jews, had married unbelievers, heathens, pagans, that Nehemiah yelled at them, cursed at them, struck some of them, and pulled their hair out. Did you know that? See how they handled it differently? Ezra's was self-harm. Nehemiah went after them. The anger's the same. How dare a believer marry an unbeliever? But the methods on how they vented that anger was slightly different. Who do you think handled it better? Ezra or Nehemiah? Well, I like Paul's way better. See, that the question has never been, can a believer divorce an unbeliever? That has never been a question. The answer to that has always been yes. So Paul's not steering us away from that. Here's what Paul's saying. He's giving us something new. He's saying, hey, I know it's the biblical thing not to be unequally yoked. A believer should never be with an unbeliever, but New Testament grace. Hey, if it's working out, why break that person's heart? Why tear their guts out? Why destroy that home? If it's working out, stay with them. You may be able to lead them through your love to Christ. Well, worship team, you better come up or I'll start reading another verse. We want to close in prayer here. I know this is tough stuff. It's tough stuff to hear. It's tough stuff to share. I know I'll get a lot of flack out there for the things I shared with you over the past 4 weeks. It's controversial. You know why it's controversial? Because anytime anyone speaks on this topic, it's controversial. But I'm not allowed to just ignore it. So I have come with as solid of arguments as I can, balancing all of Scripture. That's so important because we're going to get to, like, if we continue on in the study, we're going to get to verse 49 of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And after all that we've learned, 39, and we're going to read a verse like this. A wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives. But if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. We're going to get to a verse like that after having learned everything that we've learned. And if we're not careful, that verse is going to absolutely just stick us again. And we're going to say, oh, no. I was wrong. There's no exceptions. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he's still kicking. And only if he dies is she free to remarry. And that's where we get problems. We're not balancing everything out. Paul's making a simple case there. He's speaking to the widow. He's saying, yeah, you know, you're bound by law to your husband as long as he's alive. That's not including any of the exceptions. But if he dies, you're free to remarry. And he's saying to the widows, I think you're better off if you don't remarry, but if you want to, go for it. That's how we get so mixed up on this topic. I just want us to have this down. Would you do me a favor and commit some time to going back through these messages? I know, maybe not right away. Give yourself a break. We've exhausted it. Maybe that's what it feels like. Would you commit to learning this stuff? so that you don't read those verses and just get stuck and think that's the only verse on the topic. That's what so many Christians do. And that's why we have the mess that we do and the confusion that we do.